I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. He grew up in the urban core of Kansas City, experienced homelessness, attended the Barstow School, and went on to become a lawyer. Today, Councilman Quentin Lucas's run against Jolie Justice for mayor of the city. We'll ask Lucas how he's different from his opponent, what he wants to do on affordable housing, and what he thinks about capping tax abatements for developers. Then, if you're thinking of adopting a shelter dog, you may not know what you've got until you bring it home. Veterinarian Wayne Hunhausen is here with advice on what to consider when choosing a dog and how to make it comfortable in its new surroundings. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In exactly 20 days from now, Kansas Cityans will be electing a new mayor. It's down to Quentin Lucas or Jolie Justice. Councilwoman Justice was on the show Friday sharing her views. Now a conversation with Councilman Lucas, who says that time and time again, I've led on substantive policy issues. Councilman Justice takes a different view. In a message to voters on her website, she says voters in Kansas City need to know that you can't trust Quentin Lucas. Time and time again, he says one thing and does something totally different. And for good measure, she labels Lucas untrustworthy and ineffective. Councilman Lucas is the third district at-large councilman, a lawyer, and a law professor to boot. Councilman, welcome back. Nice to have you here.
It's good to be with you, Steve, and good to talk to your audience.
It's been a while since Kansas City has experienced hard-nosed rhetoric in a race for mayor, but now we've got it. Voters can't trust Quentin Lucas, Jolie Justice says. She says that you say one thing, you do something different, you're untrustworthy, you're ineffective. What do you make of it?
Well, first things first, I always liked Jolie. We've had a good relationship. I've known her for several years. That rhetoric is not the Jolie Justice I know. I know in campaigns sometimes you get surrounded by a bunch of hard-nosed people. I know she's got a lot of folks from the East Coast and all these other consulting firms that are working on this race, and I would have to think that that's the rhetoric they're using. The people of Kansas City know better. They know, first of all, that we don't like mayoral races like this one. If you remember Mike Burke and Sly James, it was one where they talked about the issues, they talked about the future. Frankly, Mark Funkhauser and Alvin Brooks was similar. Kay Barnes' first race. I mean, these are not the types of politics that we need. It reflects what's going on in Washington, what's going on in Jefferson City, and I don't think the people of Kansas City necessarily want to hear that. So I would recommend to the councilwoman that she turn things in a more positive direction, because that's what people want to hear.
Is there something about her that you'd like to tell us in a way of response, I guess?
No, frankly. I mean, I think anybody who has watched my work on city council knows that I have been consistent on things relating to affordable housing. I've been consistent in talking about tax incentive reform. I've been a consistent supporter of public safety. I'm somebody who is honest and ethical in everything that I do. I don't even know necessarily where the critiques are coming from. I assume it might be airport stuff, and I don't know if the councilwoman wants to talk about who had more of a hand in kind of that messy airport process, but I'm proud of the work I've done, and I think that's why I got through the primary in a field of about 200 people, and why I'm in the position I am now.
Councilman Quentin Lucas is my guest. You know, there are a lot of Kansas Cityans who have told me that either one of you would make for a good mayor. What do you say to that? Is that a fair statement?
You know, I think there are real differences between our approaches. I think you've seen it in this race. You've seen it in how we've legislated. On a number of different issues, I've really led. I don't talk about just rolling up my sleeves and having a conversation, as I think the councilwoman does. I spend a lot more time coming up with new transformative policies. If you look at our legislative records, I've introduced twice the number of ordinances that she has. And those ordinances have been in messy and interesting areas, relating to transparency and openness on that airport project, relating to how do we rehab more affordable housing for the poorest Kansas Cityans, trying to address issues in collaboration with superintendents of every school in Kansas City to make sure that we're actually having fair and equitable economic development policy and incentives. I mean, that is, I think, where there is a key difference, and we have different views on that. One other point, is that I think we have different views on how to come up with the answers for the future of Kansas City. You'll hear my opponent talk a lot about going down to Jefferson City and having conversations. I think if you look at what's come out of Jefferson City the last week, the last 2 weeks, that is not the model I want to follow. I want to fix real neighborhood issues right here in Kansas City and make city governments more efficient, deliver services, but thinking about the poorest in our society.
Now, you two got into it a bit at a recent debate over at Rockhurst. Councilwoman Justice claimed that you are more comfortable opining on social media than following through on legislation. What do you say to that?
I mean, that's hogwash. I mean, that's absolute malarkey. And look, that attack, the other recent attacks, he can't be trusted. I mean, it reeks of desperation more than it reflects anything about positive campaigning.
But she says that your affordable housing agenda has stalled in a number of key places, and you haven't done enough to get that policy through. That's an example, she says.
Sure. I mean, I kind of get her criticism, although I think if she was interested in affordable housing, then I would ask the question of why has she not been to a single housing committee meeting during her 4 years on city council? Mm-hmm. We'd love her help. I introduced and personally wrote, I've now probably written about 12 pieces of legislation relating to housing and affordable housing and the creation of more affordable housing in Kansas City. The particular piece of legislation she's talking about, I've been working with lawyers from Legal Aid of Western Missouri, the Urban Neighborhood Initiative and Diane Cleaver and others to make sure that we actually get the piece of legislation right. It's not being held up. We're actually trying to get something impactful done. So it's not just one of those ordinances or resolutions that we pass too often at City Hall where nothing happens and nothing improves, but instead to be something really substantive. I am darn proud of the work I've done in the housing arena. I think it's more than we've seen in several decades. I had a conversation actually with former mayor and Congressman Emanuel Cleaver about it just this weekend, about how we're doing a lot of good work now, how we have more work to do, and frankly, how we all should be proud of the progress we've made for the first time in probably 30 years. So I think that attack misses the mark, like many of the rest of them. I would prefer, I'm happy to talk about the substance of it, but these sorts of procedural attacks really do reflect the politics of somewhere else and nothing related to solving the problems of Kansas City.
Hey, give me a yes or no here, Quentin. Is Jolie Justice a decisive leader?
No. And I immediately want to say that respectfully because I'm trying to be a nice person. But look, I think if you look at a number of things, let's take a look at the airport issue, for example. It's been interesting kind of in this campaign seeing it. There was a press conference. There was a meeting, first of all, about a no-bid contract in a private club, kind of the back room politics that a lot of us wish to avoid. She then stood at a press conference and said we were going to do a no-bid contract on the airport. Then several weeks later, they changed their mind, which I think was inconsistent. And then when we were pushing for transparency, we saw once again this fight that we were having at council about the airport issue. I think what I've seen during this political campaign, she said, I think our second debate, that there never was a no-bid contract and that she had suggested to the bidder at the time, Burns and McDonnell, that they needed to actually reach out to all the individual council members and have their lobbyists and consultants do it. That's not leadership, let alone decisive or not. That's not leadership.
She mishandled the KCI issue, the terminal issue.
I think there's a mishandling of the KCI issue. I think there is this idea of that wasn't decisive. The decisive position would have been, this is the right way to go. I'm going to sell it. I'm going to make sure I'm meeting with every council member to make sure it gets done. And I'll give you another example, which listeners may not know. I mean, you all may recall that there were two different MOU votes on the airport. The first one failed.
Memorandum of understanding.
Correct. Yeah. To kind of get the contract and the deal done. The first one failed at city council by a vote of 4-9. On the four side were Councilwoman Justice, Mayor James, Jermaine Reed, and Catherine Shields. The second one passed by, I think, just about that flipped number, perhaps 8-5. Who was the person who did the work to get those votes changed? It was not Jolie Justice. It was not Mayor James. It was Catherine Shields, mm-hmm. of all people. Mm-hmm. It was Catherine Shields, I know, who came to my office. She came to the offices of lots of other city council people and said, we need to get the airport deal done, and we need to be responsible with it, and it's time to move on. And I give her credit for decisive leadership there, not our airport chair, who really did not take to speaking to us often during the airport process.
Again, Quentin Lucas, a candidate for Kansas City mayor, is my guest. Jolie Justice wants to create something called a City Department of Transportation to oversee streets and ridding the city of potholes. What do you think of that idea?
I don't understand why we're going to duplicate what already exists at City Hall. If any of you go to the Department of Public Works website today, their job is basically roads, bridges, right? Pedestrian trails, right? In the city to make sure.
So we've already
moves.
Got it.
We've got it. We've got a Department of Transportation. It is called, right? In essence, the Public Works Department. We work with Ride KC and the KCATA. We have a planning department. The way to fix those problems of having different silos at City Hall is not to create a new unfunded silo. The idea is we need to actually just do a better job with what we've got. We don't need a new Department of Transportation. We don't need new bureaucracy. When we're talking about how we better plan for our road infrastructure for the future, the idea there needs to be that Public Works needs to do what we promised we would do when we passed the GO bonds. We need to only invest, right, with GO bond money into existing roads. We did not do that. Councilwoman Justice supported a $9 million road to nowhere effort, which is a new road to a speculative development project in the northland of Kansas City that doesn't even connect at another end. So we're building kind of a one-way road for $9 million, which is money that should have gone to repair streets like Warnell, like Gregory, like North Oak Traffic Way that wasn't done this year. So, yeah, Department of Transportation, intriguing idea. But what we really need to do is make sure the Department of Public Works actually works and make sure we're delivering services at City Hall before just adding more bureaucrats.
Let's talk about your record, Councilman. What's the best thing you've managed to accomplish in your 4 years in the City Council?
I would say social workers at KCPD. You know, that was something that
police department, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's something I first started talking about years ago. Recognizing that there is a need for more than just a police officer to resolve things, and that we require police officers often to be in social worker roles. It was my view that we needed to both fund and truly support the social worker program in every patrol division of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. That's something that I've talked about with the city manager. That's something I was able to push in the budget, and that's something that's funded now. We need to make sure the funding remains permanent. But I think as we talk about public safety, which is one of our most important issues in the city, if not the most important. It's my view that that needs to be partially a conversation about policing, how many you have and all of that. And I'm proud to be supported by the Fraternal Order of Police. But you also need to talk about social workers, school resource officers, and once and for all, addressing long-term mental health issues in Kansas City. Because as I've noted a few times, I heard it in a promo for this show, you know, the biggest mental health institution in Kansas City is the Jackson County Jail. Hmm. That's a real problem.
Yeah. What's the one thing that's got to get accomplished during a four-year term if you become mayor?
There are so many, Steve, but yeah. I think the most important thing
what
for
can
us,
voters hang their hats on?
You know, what they can hang their hats on is that we'll beat off of the top 10 most dangerous cities list. We have been on the FBI's top 10 most dangerous cities list for, Steve, almost my entire life.
Yeah.
And I'm young, but not that young. And I think that is something that we need to really make sure we address. The city can only be so great. You can build all the wonderful things in the world. But if we have an excess of 120 or so homicides every year, if people in every neighborhood of Kansas City are talking about drug houses, I was walking a Northland neighborhood this morning in southern Clay County, and people were talking about crime up there. I mean, it is something we need to seriously address. I want to hang my hat on 4 years from now. We've made substantial progress in getting off that list.
Why can't this city get its arms around the violent crime issue? What is it about Kansas City that's made this so intractable? Other communities, I'm thinking of New York City on the East Coast, Oakland on the West Coast, have had a lot more success. Why can't Kansas City get it straight?
You know, I'll say this as a first step. It is eerily easy. It's never been my life, but it's eerily easy to not see issues in a different neighborhood, to not know the full extent of it. And so I might suggest if your only relationship with violent crime is the first 2 or 3 minutes of the local news, then perhaps it doesn't seem to prevail upon your life in the same way that it does for someone else who's living closer to it. And so I think probably for us, a first key step is recognizing the real crisis that we're in. And recognizing and explaining how it has an impact in every neighborhood of Kansas City. The fact that drug traffickers are operating with impunity in some areas of our city, leading to violent crime, means that there's more drug trafficking in other parts of the city. It means that there will be more young people getting involved. I mean, that is a big step one. I think a step two does relate to the space of our city.
We're spread out.
Right. And so even if you are in an area that's dangerous, let's say the east zone of Kansas City Police Department, which runs from about Prospect on east in the city, you can say, well, it wasn't next to me. And we need to spend a lot more time thinking about how much that is impacting us, the cost of violent crime on people, the cost of crime on the hopes of so many people, young people in particular in Kansas City.
So the city already spends, 76-77% of its general fund on fire and police, general protection mm-hmm. kinds of services. So where do you go in terms of concrete steps forward? Do you got to hire more officers,
right.
more social workers? Use the police differently? What's the Quentin Lucas plan here?
Yeah, the simple plan is this. One, in connection with the budget issue, you spend whatever you need to make sure that you're addressing the core issue, right? You spend what you need to make sure people are safe.
More or less than we're spending now?
It may well be more, Steve. I think when we look at the budget right now, first of all, that 76% of the budget number comes from the general fund as compared to all of the other things that go into the city. Enterprise funds like the water department, aviation, dedicated taxes, et cetera. So that's not quite, not three quarters of every dollar are going just to that. There are lots of other things that happen. But in terms of what we do, two words, resources and relationships. On the resources point, I do think we make sure that we're deploying police in a way that relates to neighborhood policing more on the community side. That would be giving officers the opportunity to spend more time in sectors of the city. A comparison would be for those.
I thought we were doing that already.
We've invested in community interaction officers. I think with the idea that if you have an officer, one or two in each patrol division, they'll be the ones that get to talk to people. I want to see us get closer to that classic idea of a beat cop, mm-hmm. right? For those who may remember that either from TV shows or knowing it in
the relationships
life.
Get formed right. is where you're going
exactly.
here, right?
You really do make sure relationships are formed. There is also, and it's not lost on me that I'd get to be a member of the Board of Police Commissioners, the idea of how is the police department spending that money that's coming in? If you look at the budget in the last year, it's eerily close amount of the budget that goes into the administrative bureau and the patrol bureau.
And again, I thought those numbers were changing with time. There's been news about that over the years
right.
that we're going to get the administrative guys out back on the street again.
Right. They're supposed to be changing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we need to continue to push because I think the patrol bureau, the folks that you and I see out and about every day, are the ones we need to see more of. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important for an officer to be able to build up a relationship. I've now done three ride-alongs with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. I'm not sure if my opponent's done any. And in those three ride-alongs, what I have seen is that often in the east zone or the center zone, you have an officer who's going from one scene, not a lot of time there to process. They're driving miles and miles to another spot, not a lot of time to process. And when you're talking about issues relating to interviewing a domestic violence victim or asking about criminal activity or drug activity in a neighborhood, you need that time. You need that investment in the community. You need that investment in detectives. And that's what I think we need more of.
But again, this is where Quentin Lucas wants to go. If you win a 4-year term as mayor of this city, you want to focus heavily on crime. That's the one thing you want to begin to turn around.
I'll be very proud of that because having been to funerals of homicide victims, there is nothing more tragic than a life that's cut down too early. And it's something we need to address, and it holds Kansas City back. And no matter all the bells and whistles we have tomorrow, it will continue to hold Kansas City back.
Different topic, Councilman. There's a lot of speculation in this race that you want a new city manager. You apparently think that Troy Schulte hasn't done the job. Is that right?
No, that's absolutely incorrect, too. I mean, here's the deal. I'm running.
You keep him on a city manager.
I would keep him on a city manager. I'm running to make a difference and a positive impact on Kansas City. And frankly, I'm running to get things done. I think this city manager has an ability to do so. I disagree with some of the things the mayor has directed him to do. I disagree entirely with the airport process, which was a disaster. But at the same time, I actually think that the city manager knows a lot about the things I care about. How do we rehab more housing? How do we, instead of demolishing our community, invest more in preservation? How do we make sure we have a city that's safer? And that's the sort of work that I'll be doing. So no, it's not I'm coming in and changing ships. And one of the more laughable things I hear, Steve, is that one of those rumors being pushed around, they're saying, well, you're going to fire the city manager and replace him with Catherine Shields.
And I've heard that.
And, you know, I think the world of Catherine, but, you know, I think if Catherine was the city manager, I would become the least important and the least powerful mayor in the history of Kansas City, Missouri. And
so she's good at doing that. Yes, she is. And she knows how to lead. Yeah.
It's my view that, no, I think I look forward to working with Troy. I think we have a lot of good things to do, but I think we need to reorient our focus to momentum being shared in all neighborhoods of Kansas City, not just a few.
Voters just roundly rejected that early childhood education tax increase a few months ago. Would you push for a revised plan during a term as mayor, or is that not on your first tier list of things to get done?
Yeah, I'd push for a revised plan, but with the leadership coming out of our schools. Right. I'm not a trained educator. I'm an educator now, but I'm an attorney by training.
But you're not opposed to putting a tax increase on the ballot for early childhood if you can get a plan that you agree with working with school leaders.
What I would like to see is any tax increase. So I'm not necessarily opposed to it. I would like to see it come from the school districts themselves. I'd like to see perhaps a unified set of school districts saying that we're interested in a mill levy increase to help support early childhood education. That's something that I would love to put the might of the mayor's office behind. I do not think that we should resort to sales taxes. I do not think that Kansas City, Missouri needs to add yet another bureaucracy in connection with us running one important part of public education.
You hear it more and more these days that Kansas Citians are starting to say we're taxed enough. We don't want to do it anymore. You just suggested that perhaps if the right plan could get your support for an early childhood thing. Are there other initiatives out there that you'd be willing to raise taxes for?
No. No, I am one of those who believes that we have gone to the well quite a bit lately.
Mm-hmm. Even for affordable housing, one of your key issues.
I think the world of affordable housing, and I think it's important, and I think it's a key issue as someone who grew up experiencing homelessness myself. That being said, the voters have approved a lot of taxes to help support that issue. We have an 8-cent sales tax, the Central City Economic Development sales tax, for which housing can be one use. I was criticized by my opponent for saying that perhaps we want to see how we can support more multifamily development projects and single family on the east side of Kansas City from that tax. I think that's actually just smart. It's $10 million dollars a year we're generating. Let's try to get some of that money to make sure we're retaining residents in the east side of Kansas City, Missouri.
But you're also in a city council that's approved a resolution saying it needs a $75 million housing trust fund.
I wrote that.
And that trust fund has got exactly $0 in it right now. So how do you get the money for that?
Oh, I'm delighted to talk about that. I think there are a few different ways to get it. Right now, so I've already identified that you have your $10 million east side fund, which, frankly, I think there can be a percentage of that that goes to help support affordable housing development. We'll go through the same process. We have to bring projects, all of that. But I think that could be a helpful thing that will build opportunities on the east side. At 27th and Prospect, we just built a multifamily development near the Morningstar Missionary Baptist Church.
That's still a long way from $75 million.
That's still a long way, but you know, how do you get to $75 million a dollar at a time? You know, another way you do it too is, I mean, and I understand we're going to have to add funds together. I think we also have to look to our annual allotment from HUD. We get $8 million a year from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. How do we spend it? I think it's fair to critique it and say not always that well. This year there were proposals for up to $800,000 of parking lots. We don't need to spend housing money on parking lots. I think you start to add it up through there, and that's how you do it. What I don't think we do is just say, hey, let's go for another tax increase, another fund, and much like we've seen with GO bonds, then start this fight for how people can spend the money incorrectly, frankly.
I want to finish. We're running short of time here, but there's a lot of interest, at least in some quarters, about the idea of bringing the Royals to a downtown baseball stadium. But that idea, you have said this, we need a new downtown baseball stadium like I need a new Maserati. Do you need a new Maserati?
I'd love it, but I can't afford it. And that's the problem. I mean, look, I understand we'll have long-term issues with the stadiums. I look forward to having those conversations. Planning is always important. Before we plan that, I think your critique on housing and where we get the money from is justified. Critiques on folks saying we need to improve infrastructure are justified. Let's make sure we're taking care of the basics. Let's make sure we're fixing our house before we're building a brand new deck to look real fancy.
Okay, that's Councilman Quentin Lucas. He's a candidate for Kansas City Mayor. He'll be on the ballot here in 20 days. Thanks for your views. Be safe out there. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you, Steve. I look forward to our debate, I believe, next week.
Next week at the Chamber of Commerce. I'm looking forward to that, too. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about how to adopt a pet. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, Councilman Lee Barnes and Dwayne Williams discussed their campaign platforms for the 5th District at-large City Council seat in Kansas City. Hear more about their campaigns at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow on the show, he's been in the job for 14 years. She just started this year. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk to U.S. Representatives Emmanuel Cleaver and Charisse Davids. Join us tomorrow for that conversation. Well, according to the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, about 1.6 million dogs are adopted from animal shelters each year. They range from puppies to oldsters, purebreds to mixed breeds, and their background and experiences may be a total mystery. So how do you go about making the transition from shelter to a new home as easy as possible for the dog? Back with us to offer some advice is Wayne Hunhausen, veterinarian, animal behaviorist, and founder of Westwood Animal Hospital. Wayne, always good to have you here. Welcome.
Great to be here.
I gather we should start maybe with selecting a dog at the shelter. What do we need to have in mind before we make the trip to select a dog? What needs to happen?
Well, you need to think about your lifestyle, how that pet's going to fit into your home environment. Are you an active person? Do you want a working breed dog where you can go out and hike or maybe jog with the dog? Or are you a bit more of a couch potato who likes to sit there and watch Netflix all day with a little fluffy thing in your lap?
Yeah.
So those are really important things to think
about. So your lifestyle makes a difference to the kind of dog you have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has to be a good fit. And if there's not, then it's just not going to be a good relationship and it'll sour.
So the trick then is you go to the shelter, and how do you figure out in those pivotal minutes that you're walking around which pet you might have a good relationship with?
Yeah, it's always a challenge, and it'll depend on the shelter too. But hopefully during the adoption process, you'll have an opportunity to take the pet into an area where there are not a lot of distractions, and you're looking for a pet that has confidence interacting with people, that's not afraid to walk up to you.
Is friendly and not growling in the process.
Yeah,
right?
And not growling, right. Yeah. That can always be a deal breaker. If you have the bigger area, they may have some toys available where you can throw a toy and see if the pet's interested and active and engaging in a toy. Maybe might even play fetch for you, possibly.
So you want to be able to spend some quality time, if you will.
Exactly. And if you find a pet that you like, but maybe the pet can have an off day just like a person can. So it doesn't mean that that first interaction, if your things aren't completely settled, that you're going to give up on the pet. You might want to come back another time a week later and see how the pet's doing, and maybe it's going to be more active or more interactive during a following visit.
That's interesting. So do pets, and I guess we're talking mostly about dogs here, do they behave differently on different days, just like sort of people do? They're moody or whatever?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I always think of dogs as being always the same all the time.
Yeah, their behavior will vary, and it'll depend on their activity level, if they got to walk on that day or not, and it'll depend on what's going on. Some dogs are maybe a little bit nervous and maybe withdrawn. If it's stormy weather, that'll change the behavior. Just the way it is these last couple of weeks here in Kansas City, that will affect some of the dogs in the shelter who might be a little more nervous.
So how much information will a shelter typically have on any dog, or I guess cat for that matter, that it's taking care of? I mean, can you count on very much information?
Not always. Yeah. Of course, there are a number of dogs that will come in off the streets that are picked up strays, and you have no information at all. Otherwise, you're depending on the information that they get at intake and whether the family can provide or will provide honest information. And so the more information you get, the better off it is, especially if you have children at home or other dogs at home or cats. You really would like to know about whether or not this dog that you're thinking about adopting is social in those situations.
Yeah. If you have questions about adopting a pet, how to go about doing it, Dr. Wayne Hunhausen is in the house. Our number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Do the shelters give the animal a physical, and is there some basic health care provided at the point that the shelter begins to assume responsibility for the dog?
Yeah, most shelters will do that, and it kind of depends on the financial status of the shelter. In some areas, there are less that they can do, but most of the shelters that are really active here in the Kansas City area, they'll provide an input physical examination. If there are any issues, whether it's intestinal worms or heart worms or maybe some skin problems, usually they'll address those, maybe even as far as fixing a broken leg or casting a leg that's broken. So they'll provide a lot of care, and they'll do a behavioral assessment too. And so there are a number of things they can do to get a reasonable idea on whether the pet's shy or friendly or maybe has some aggressive tendencies.
So the shelter can tell you some of those things as a way of a starter kit of information, if you will. Yeah,
exactly.
Are there some basic commands that I should test out on the dog while I'm there? I mean, should I expect the dog to be able to fetch or not?
Yeah, no, fetching, you know, if the pet came from a home where the pet knew how to fetch, and then yes, you might see that, but I wouldn't count on that. And with a number of shelter pets, there's going to be some degree of anxiety being in the shelter and all the noise and activity, and you won't normally see the play behavior that you might see in your home environment. Another bonus in most of the shelters these days, they will provide some obedience training on basic commands like come on command and sit on command and walk
really?
On a leash.
Yeah.
And if the dog knows that, they'll probably be proud to show that off to you. And cause that's a bonus, taking a dog home that's already had a little bit of training is obedient.
Yeah, I was going to say the environment of the shelter is very much unlike the environment of someone's home. At least you hope so. You know, lots of barking dogs and sort of some chaos there that they're not going to find at home.
Yeah.
So would you expect the dog that you see at the shelter to be the same dog that you bring home? Now that I think about it a little bit?
No, you'll see some changes. And sometimes the dog that you get in the shelter is going to be the same dog you take home.
Yeah.
When you take it home and 3 months later and 6 months later, a year later. But there are some dogs that are a little bit more withdrawn in the shelter, and they may blossom for good or bad once they get in the home.
Yeah.
And so you see some dogs on the good end of the spectrum that seem withdrawn, but they get home and they have confidence and they got a good family interaction. They'll blossom and they're playful and they're social and do great. On the other hand, there are in some situations where I'll see a dog that was kind of quiet, not really reactive when they adopted the pet, but it gets enough confidence after about 3 months being in a home that it might start displaying some of the behaviors that it had before it entered the shelter, like maybe protective behaviors or territorial behaviors or more reactive barking and so forth. So there's always a few question marks when you adopt from a shelter in regard to what you're going to have at home.
Okay, you're talking about bringing the animal home. How can I make my home ready for the dog before I get it in the house? What should I be thinking about? That's a big moment for the new pet.
Yeah. So you don't know what the dog's behavior tendency is going to be in regard to maybe being destructive or getting into things, or maybe doesn't have any boundaries or never had any boundaries in previous homes. And so you want to have a plan for confinement, safe confinement when you're not around. So it might be a kennel, or it might be some people use exercise pens, or usually 4x4 foot collapsible pens, which I think are a little bit nicer because they give the dog a little bit more room to move around.
What is that exactly?
Well, they call them, the typical ones are called exercise pens. They're available in most pet stores, and they're collapsible wire gates, basically. So they're about 3 to 4 feet tall and 4x4 feet on side. And so they're nice because they'll collapse down where you can put them in a closet, but you can bring them out and set them up in maybe the kitchen area or family room area when you're gone. Mm-hmm. And so that gives the dog more room than a kennel, the small kennel, which is just enough room to get up, stand up, and turn around in.
Yeah, okay. What else should I be thinking about for my house when I bring the dog home?
Well, you want to keep that dog mentally busy and out of trouble. And so so you want to have some good toys to keep the dog busy so it's got something to put its mouth on besides the furniture or the clothing and so forth. And so the toys that I recommend are toys that you can put food in. You want to make the toys more interesting than your stuff. And so Kong toys that can be stuffed with soft food and kibble, or in particular, I like these kibble balls. They're usually plexiglass balls or hard rubber balls that have holes in them. You can put the treats or the dog's dinner kibble in there, and the pet has to push these around. And as they roll around, treats fall out of the holes.
Oh, really?
And so it provides a lot of mental stimulation for the pet and fun activity.
And you can get those at pet stores as well?
Yeah. Over the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a big movement in producing a lot of toys that provide challenges. They have simple toys, like I mentioned, that are squares or round or egg-shaped. And then they have actually puzzle toys where the dog has to learn to shove a little door to the left or the right for the treat to appear. So there are a lot of real sophisticated toys out there these days.
It might be good for adults, too.
Yes.
Keep them straight. Dr. Wayne Hunthausen is in the house. We're talking about good ways to bring home a pet from a shelter, a dog from a shelter, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I know you recommend having the dog thoroughly examined by a vet, but can that wait until it's relaxed in its new surroundings and I've bonded with the dog a little bit?
Well, it's nice to have, it depends on the shelter that you adopt from. Mm-hmm. And if they're really thorough and the pet's had a really good physical exam and there are no physical problems by a accredited veterinarian that have been noted, then you're probably okay waiting for a while. If the pet comes out of a shelter where they don't have it, the vet care that they'd like to have, then yes, I would take the pet in within 3 days and have it examined by a veterinarian and see if there are any issues they need to know about from the start.
How important is it when you have a new pet in the house to, as you leave the house, to keep them confined? It sounds like you're saying you need to be thinking about something at least for a while because you don't know what the dog's going to do.
Exactly. And probably the younger the dog, the more important that is.
Yeah.
And most dogs are pretty active up till about a year and a half to 2 years of age. So depending on the dog and the temperament and the breed, you usually have to have some plan to keep them out of trouble until they start maturing and become less mature and less active.
Liz called us to ask us this question, Dr. Hunthausen. Should you get health insurance for a pet that you get, and how do you deal with homeowner insurance? That's a good question.
Well,
I thought about that.
Yeah, the health insurance has become more and more popular here in the Midwest over the last maybe 10 or 15 years because the veterinary care that we can provide is a lot more sophisticated than we have in the past.
You're doing major procedures these
days.
Yes,
because now we have board-certified ophthalmologists and orthopedic surgeons and cardiologists.
No
and
kidding.
We have MRIs available and CAT scans available for pets.
Do you do all that at your animal hospital?
No, some of that. CAT scans and MRIs, you'll have to go to a specialty clinic typically to have those done because you're talking about a big investment. And those type of tools aren't used on a daily basis in a family practice.
Mm-hmm.
But the specialty hospitals offer those. And so the more sophisticated the treatment plans are, the more expensive it gets. And so now if you could end up spending anywhere from $3,000 to $10,000 possibly on multiple fractures from a dog that's been hit by a car or to maybe a geriatric pet that's showing some cognitive problems where they're suspecting brain problems and might require an MRI. So that said, yes, health insurance I think is a good idea for most people, but it depends. It's like there are different types of layers of health care too, just like for people. And you can get certain deductibles.
I was going to say $1,000 deductible.
Exactly.
Sort of the common one. Yeah.
And you can get a care that would just take care of emergencies and big bills, or you can get something that provides some coverage for regular health exams and dental exams and things like
mm-hmm.
that.
How about establishing routines with your new dog in the house? How important is routine? How much can that help in the settling in process?
Routines, consistency are so important whether you're raising kids or you're raising
dogs. Tell me about it. Some things are alike.
Yeah. don't you?
Yeah, don't you know? Yeah.
So that's another thing you think about before you bring the pet home. What are the rules going to be? And do I want the pet to be allowed in the furniture or not? Do I want to allow the pet to get in certain areas of the yard or not? Do I want to a pet that's can jump all over people when they come inside or not? What are the rules going to be?
Mm-hmm.
And right away, you need to set those rules and you be consistent in either dissuading the pet from doing the problem behavior or reinforcing what you want the pet to do.
Well, say if you decide you don't want the dog going on a couch.
Mm-hmm.
How do you ensure that that happens?
Well, when you're there, there are a number of things you can do. And typically, my go-to to interrupt the behavior that I don't want doesn't involve yelling at the pet or certainly no physical correction. But if a pet starts to do something like get on the couch or get its nose in a trash can, what I'll usually use is a sharp, novel, or somewhat loud noise to interrupt the behavior.
So a little horn.
It could be a horn, possibly. What you use to interrupt the behavior, whether the pet's jumping up or getting in the trash or whatever, has to match the pet's temperament. And so you might use a hand clap. You might use a shake can, a can with some coins in it. You might use a hiker's whistle, or you could use a loud boat horn if you have a big dog that's barking loud and you need something to get the dog's attention. But the criteria is for the noise device is it should stop the behavior immediately, but shouldn't cause any anxiety, and the pet should recover from it pretty quickly. If you make a noise, maybe it doesn't sound too loud to you, but your pet runs off to the corner and pees, then that's too much for that pet, and you got to tailor that down, or you're going to ruin your relationship with the pet. So that said, you can interact with the pet, maybe even keep it on a leash more so it can't get up on the chair while you're training it, and that takes care of things when you're there. But the big challenge for keeping the dog off the couch or to stop it from counter surfing is, what do you do when you're not around? Mm-hmm. And so for a couch, a simple thing that'll work with some dogs, you can buy this vinyl carpet protector that you put down hallways. A lot of times you'll see these in show houses, and they have these little prongs in the bottom so they don't slip around. Well, you can take this and cut a section of that and turn it upside down and put it on your couch. And the prongs aren't sharp enough to hurt the pet, but they're not comfortable to lie on. And so you provide a nice dog bed on the floor so the dog has a choice. Well, I can sleep in this fluffy little bed, or I can sleep in this gnarly thing.
Yeah.
And so that can help shape the behavior. Or another thing you can use, there are alarms that are made for pets, motion-activated alarms. We sell a lot of these in our training center because you have these young dogs that people can't, you know, they do have problems when the family's not around. And so you slip one of these in between the cushions on a couch, and when the pet jumps up on the couch makes a loud noise to teach the pet to get off of it. And so you let the environment apply the correction.
You guys think of everything these days.
Well, you have to dig deep into your bag sometimes.
Yeah. Dr. Wayne Hunhausen from the Westwood Animal Hospital is my guest. You know, older dogs are often overlooked at shelters, it seems to me, but are there some advantages in picking one because they're a little more mature, perhaps?
Well, certainly. And most older dogs are going to be calmer. So if you have a young dog, you need to set aside some time to go out and exercise with that dog. Walk it a couple times a day, maybe if you got a working dog, a hunting dog that's living in an urban setting, you may have to go out and jog with it a couple of times a day.
Yeah.
And so an older dog is typically not going to require as much exercise from you. Usually it's beyond the stage where it's going to be really destructive. So that can be an advantage. You don't have to go through so much confinement there initially. They're just easier trained. They pay more attention to people. They're not as distracted by their environment.
Right.
So there are a lot of advantages to considering an older pet.
Yeah. Do people mostly gravitate towards younger ones? Is that just how it works?
Yes, I think probably puppies are top of the list when people go out to shelters. And I don't know if they should always be at the top of the list because puppies are a lot of work.
Yeah.
And puppies can be pretty obnoxious sometimes too.
Oh, really?
They take a lot of patience.
Yeah. You know, some dogs are brought to shelters by their owners, you know, for a whole host of reasons, including disabilities. What I wanted to ask about was deafness, since I'm told there are more than 30 breeds prone to being deaf. How do you train a dog when your voice is useless?
Yeah, that is definitely a challenge. And there are some breeds, like you mentioned, that have a higher incidence of deafness, and in particular, white dogs. And they're in the ear, there are certain...
You said white dogs?
White dogs, yes.
And dogs that are white tend to be deaf?
Yes.
Like, why is there a connection between the color of the coat and...
Okay.
Deafness.
There are certain cells in the ear that are important for hearing that have pigment in them. They have they're called melanocytes, and they have pigment in them. And so the dogs that are white or predominantly white are less likely to have the required pigments in those cells. And if they don't have that pigment, these cells tend to deteriorate within a few weeks after birth. And so Boxers, Dalmatians, Bull Terriers, those all, about 20% of the dogs that are white or predominantly white in those breeds are going to be deaf. And the other important thing is the gene that controls the white color also has an influence on the eye color. So if you have a dog that's all white and it has blue eyes, then the incidence of or the likelihood of deafness increases by about another 10 to 20%.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so that's a heck of a struggle you've got in your hands to train a dog that can't hear very well.
Right. And so you can do the same type of training that we do with puppies, which is called food lure reward training. So to teach a puppy to sit or a deaf dog to sit, what I'll do is take a treat and put it right in front of the puppy's or the adult deaf dog's nose and slowly go up over the top of the head, not getting so high that the dog will jump up. But if you slowly go up over the top of the head, most dogs will look up. And as the head goes up, the rear end goes down into a sit position.
Yeah.
And then since you're moving the food upwards about 8 inches every time you do that, that upward movement of your hand becomes the signal to sit. So it's a really sweet way of teaching a dog to sit. Now, the biggest challenge is getting the dog's attention so you can have it sit for you.
Yeah.
And so if the dog's looking someplace else, well, the normal dog, you can say its name and it's going to look at you and then you can call it over. And so you have to have some way of signaling the dog to look at you. If you're in a home with wooden floors, you could tap the floor so that vibration signals to the dog to look around for the family member, and then you can use a hand signal like a wave of your hand to get the pet to come over. Otherwise, if you're in the yard or you don't have wooden floors, it'll make a sound like that when you thump them. Then what you can use is a vibration collar, and we're not talking shock collars for sure here, but they're collars that just vibrate. And so the dog can be taught to look for a family member to come to when it feels the collar vibrating a little bit. And it's real simple. You just stand in front of the dog and you give it a treat, first treat, and then you vibrate the collar and you give it another treat.
You do that remotely?
It's a remote. I'm sorry. Yes, it's a remote-activated vibrating collar. And then you vibrate and treat and vibrate and treat. And then after you do this 10 times, you let the pet start. You ignore the pet. The pet will kind of turn around. As it gets a 90-degree turn away from you, you vibrate again. And since the dog, the last time it heard a vibration, if it looked at you, it knew a treat was available, and you give it a treat. And gradually, you let the dog walk farther and farther away before you vibrate and have it come back
to
you.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, that's Dr. Wayne Hunhausen. Again, he's the proprietor at the Westwood Animal Hospital on the Kansas side of the state line. Wayne, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for the good knowledge. Well, I appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
You bet. Yesterday in the show, two physicians told us some of the reasons why young athletes are experiencing injuries like the professionals. Hear what they had to say as well as previous conversations. You'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, U.S. Representatives Emmanuel Cleaver and Charisse Davids are in the studio. Join us for that conversation. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.